Hello and welcome to Oxford Today. Professor Liz Froude had both legs amputated and faced a host of life-changing injuries after contracting the deadly blood infection sepsis in August 2015. But not only did she survive the disease, she's now committed to raising sepsis awareness, and cheered on by her family in 2016, they rode 165 miles from the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford to Cardiff Bay in Wales. And I'm delighted that Liz is with me today. Welcome to Oxford Today.
Thank you.
How are you? How are you doing? How's everything going?
Really well. Busy in the middle of term. So, yeah, things are usual Oxford madness.
Because we were just saying, before all this happened, you were involved in archaeology, and well, you still are now. But before we get on to that, I was just wondering, you know, all the attention that you've had, really. As I mentioned, you did this sort of cycle ride from Ashmolean to Cardiff. You've been on BBC Oxford just recently. What's the attention been like after everything has happened to you? Like, it must be quite overwhelming in some, to some extent.
Overwhelming is the right word, definitely, but in a really good way. So after I did the BBC interview, or after that went live a couple of weeks ago, a week ago, I've got emails from total strangers, you know, talking about how they'd never heard of sepsis and they'd never understood the potential impact of the disease. And so they were... The response has been fantastic, and within the university too. So my students and colleagues have been really awesome around all of this too. So I've been very lucky.
And if you look at sepsis generally, because you know, as you say, many people perhaps have never heard of it. I've obviously heard of sepsis. I probably couldn't tell you everything that happens during it, and I'm sure you could. But it affects, you know, around 150,000 people in the UK every year. And yeah. I think it's around 40 or 50,000 of those people actually do die.
Yeah.
But your story then, just for, save me explaining it, it's just give the listeners just a brief sort of overview of what actually happened with you then, just so they understand what's gone on.
It was August 2015, and I'd just come back from maternity leave. So I was just ready to step back into my job, and I'd just been appointed director of Torch, which is the Oxford Research Centre in the Humanities here. So I was super excited. As well, healthy, and then I started to feel sick, and it was like I'd got the flu. You know, I one evening I got, you know, the kind of shakes going through my body, and I felt really nauseous, and I thought, oh, God, you know, it's like food poisoning or some sort of stomach flu. And I took myself to bed for a couple of days, and I just got progressively sicker. And I really, by the time it was very serious and I was, you know, losing the feeling in my hands and legs and in my face, I couldn't breathe properly. By the time it was that serious, which was a couple of days later, I really was no longer functioning. And it was my husband who rang the ambulance, well, rang 911 in the early hours of the morning, because I was no longer able to breathe properly, and I was starting to get very scared, and he was starting to get very scared. It's blue lighted into the John Radcliffe in Oxford, and then total chaos after that. So, you know,
that was all within a matter of a week, really, or just a few days.
So I lose track of time span. So I'm not very clear on the time frames for things from when I got sick to when I started to be more aware of things.
Yeah.
So I ended up in ICU. I don't know how long I was in intensive care for. I think 10 days because I had went into total organ failure.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure of the time span, but I think from starting to feel ill to being blue lighted to the John Radcliffe, it was 2 or 3 days max.
So
progressed from there.
So in terms of actually, if we can understand what caused it, is there a cause? Is there a, you know, obviously you say about the symptoms you had. Was there any indication at all if it's genetics or what is it? What's the story there?
It's sepsis or septic shock in my case is caused by a bacterial infection that your body just over-responds to or overreacts to.
Yeah.
And in my case, it shut down my extremities and the blood flow to my extremities. But in my case, they don't know what caused it. We think it was pneumococcal sepsis. So some sort of pneumococcal bacteria. But I didn't have a cough or cold. You know, I kind of think, you think pneumococcal pneumonia, you'd be coughing something the week before. I didn't have anything like that. But normally, you know, it can be someone can get a cut on their arm or it's some sort of bacterial infection that invades your body and your body just overreacts in very extreme ways to it. Some people walk away from it. Some people die. And some people like me end up with extensive injuries. So it's a brutal disease. It's very difficult to diagnose. There's a lot of fuss in the press about NHS practitioners not diagnosing it fast enough. In my case, that didn't happen. The NHS were awesome all the way through. Yeah. And it was just shit, bad luck.
Yeah.
No, but in terms of the NHS then, just on that point, when they were treating you, had they seen cases like this before then? Because we talk about how many we've had across the country, but even in John Radcliffe, obviously it sounds like you're still here. You know, you're here. Within a matter of days, they saved your life, essentially.
Yes.
But what did they say? This is very. We've dealt with two or three cases before, or what did they say?
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to talk to my husband about that, because I was too far gone to really know what was going on, and I don't think I understood that I'd gone into septic shock, and I don't think I even understood what that was until probably weeks and weeks later.
Yeah.
I'm sure people were explaining it to me all the way through, but I have no memory of that until a few weeks later. But from what I remember of being in the emergency room and then going into ICU, they knew what they were dealing with straight away. Mm. So they were very clear about that. They were acting on it. I was given massive antibiotics, which is the appropriate treatment almost straight away.
So weeks and weeks pass, you sort of start to sort of gather your thoughts, you know what's going on, essentially.
Yeah.
How did you actually feel then? Because you talk in that, you talk very candidly in that BBC Oxford interview, and you say, you take your life previously back within an instant. But when you started to realise, and your husband, told you, and your family were there, or your friends, looking back now, were you just devastated? Or
absolutely devastated. And I really thought this was, you really think your life is over. I couldn't imagine being able to go back to work. And I love my job. I love my students. I love teaching. I love going to Egypt. I love everything about what I do. And I could not imagine. I remember just lying in the hospital bed, especially because I've lost the use of my hands.
Yeah,
I couldn't imagine being able to do anything. And so there was that enormous kind of sense of loss around my job, and then around my son as well. He was 11 months old when I got sick. And, I missed, because I was in hospital for 5 months, even though he was in hospital with me every day, most days, thanks to my husband. I feel like I was no longer a mother, which is just incredibly difficult to, I can't even articulate what that's like. And I felt like I'd lost my working identity. But then little things kind of bring you back. So I had colleagues very early communicating to my husband and communicating to my close friends who were there in the hospital that Oxford University had put me on medical leave. They were waiting for me to come back, that I definitely had a job. We would figure out a way. I had, colleagues telling me about voice activated software. And although all of these things felt very unreal when you're lying in a hospital bed with your hands bandaged and you're about to have your feet amputated or your legs amputated, it all felt very unreal. But there was this concrete sense beyond that unreality of okay, maybe there's a chance I can go back. Maybe this will work out.
Well, actually, because the suggestion of actually speaking to you actually came before this BBC Oxford interview. So in the public sphere, perhaps you weren't out there. Your story wasn't out there. But this is the university, actually. It's all credit to them. They actually got in touch with us, their public affairs team. Said, look into these different people, and you were one of those people as well. And I think what's perhaps interesting to a lot of people is that obviously you talk about Oxford as this academic centre of excellence, but do you think your story perhaps shows they do value, and especially archaeology, maybe the department, they value people for who they are as well, and their skills, and maybe any physical impairment or whatever doesn't change that.
Absolutely. And that's, it sounds awful. This is going to sound really awful, but I'm such a cynic around institutions. I was so cynical about big institutions, including my own, Oxford, the NHS, these kind of big institutions, and you kind of see them as maybe sometimes being a little bit faceless, and I'd been cynical around that. And I'm not, because, mostly, not entirely, but mostly people in the university have been awesome, and there's been a huge, on an individual level, a huge amount of willing support, especially in my own department.
Yeah, and before we go into all the archaeology and talking about what's more, what's the most interesting thing for both of us is the past and everything. I was wondering, so working with a disability now and not being like you were before, you've probably had a very good experience from how people have reacted, as we've said. But generally, through raising your own awareness about sepsis and disabilities, you know, do you think it's difficult that other people, perhaps in other situations and other institutions, don't have the support that you maybe had?
Yeah, definitely. And I, you know, I've hit walls with things. So, you know, there's a lot of networks in place to help disabled people get back to work, for example. So there's the Access to Work scheme, which is great and has been the thing that has allowed me to come back to work, because it pays for my research assistants, I couldn't do my job without them, because I don't have the use of my hands, and they're amazing. But to access that support, it's a brutal process. And, you know, I will get off the phone with people at Access to Work and I will be in tears, because I've been made to feel so worthless while dealing with them on the phone. And I'm a pretty resilient person, and I'm someone that can communicate clearly still. I'm someone who can argue my case well.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty privileged in being in that position. And there are a lot of people out there who are way more vulnerable, who cannot communicate their needs in the ways that I can. And no wonder people, you know, disabled people are not getting back to work in the numbers that the government would like, because the barriers are huge. And I'm very, very aware of this, and it makes me so angry.
So is that sort of, would you say that's the government's responsibility? That it's them, completely centralised government, really? Is it, or locally, Oxfordshire Council?
I think it's a central issue. And it's not individuals with an Access to Work. On an individual level, people are generally really good. It's the frameworks that are in place.
It's the bureaucracy, then.
It's the bureaucracy. It's the, I imagine that people who work for Access to Work are being told the budgets are tiny, you have to make sure that every penny is accounted for.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, that's the structure that they're working within, and that rolls out to the people that are on the receiving end of it, which is people like me. And you can be made to feel that you are somehow playing the system by asking for help. And of course we're not. We need help. So that's made me aware that, you know, I'm in a very fortunate position because I have a very supportive environment, but I'm lucky in that, and a lot of people don't have that.
So what can you do then as somebody, you know, because you were saying about the cycle, right, that happened, and it's a fantastic initiative and everything that's happened there. Is that the sort of way you raise awareness, not only of sepsis, but maybe the flaws in the system? How do you go about that, if you want to? Or
I don't know. Yeah, this is the thing. You know, I feel like you need to be shouting a lot and shouting very loudly.
Do you feel responsible, though, or not? Because people would look at you now in terms of, like, you know, you've done all this. Nobody's expecting you to do anything. But it's, in a sense, do you feel as if, or would you want to do something?
Yeah, I mean, this is something. I mean, I'm still very new to this. So I'm only 2.5 years in to this new life.
Of course,
and I'm still figuring out what directions I want to go in and how I want to be useful. But I want to be useful. And I feel like, you know, I had a nurse say to me, she was great, when I was in the Oxford Centre for Enablement, she was one of my nurses there, and she sat me down, and it was pretty brutal. She was like, you have a duty to go out there and help, and because you're articulate, because of your position, you know, you have a job that makes you interesting, that people are interested to talk to you. You have a responsibility to go out there and make things better. You're like, at that point, I wasn't.
Yeah, a lot to take on. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, really?
Yeah, great.
That was hard, but she was right, and so I'm taking little steps forward and trying to figure things out. So, you know, we've done some sepsis awareness stuff, and I'm quite keen to keep working with the UK Sepsis Trust to raise awareness around sepsis. But there's the sort of general disability awareness as well. And whether I focus my attention here or whether I focus my attention in Egypt, those are the questions I'm asking myself now. So I'm still trying to figure out where, you know, do I want to be an activist? Yes, maybe I do. And then now I have to figure out where I'm going to focus that attention, because I also have a job and a son and a family, so, you know, I can't spread myself too thin, but it's important to try to do something to make things better.
And so, going back to work then, talking about, you know you're an Egyptologist, you're an archaeologist, so, you know, you're teaching now then, are you still teaching right now?
Yeah.
But so when you went back then to teaching, was it more difficult just physically to go back, or psychologically to?
Ooh.
See, these are very, you know, oh, you got to think about these things.
Yeah. Both. Yeah. Both was really hard. So, yeah there were physical limits. You know, I get really tired very quickly, especially when I'm on my prosthetic legs. You know, that's exhausting. It's more exhausting than walking on your own legs. Yeah. So there are all sorts of physical limitations. But the psychological one was huge because from August 2015 when I got sick through till coming back to work, I came back to work in September 2016, so a year later, I'd been in totally new environments. I'd been in the hospital. When I went home, we'd moved house because I couldn't go back to my old house. So all my environments were new, and they were all semi-adapted for me. Come back to work, come back to the Sackler Library, which is where my office is, and I was back to my old place, you know, the place where I worked for 10 years, and I was fundamentally changed, and I couldn't open the goddamn doors, and I couldn't reach the books that I want to use, and that was brutal, and I probably, you know, the first couple of weeks that I was back at work in some sense, like coming back to the office most days, they were really hard to deal with, and I'd come back most days and just cry because it just rams home the loss. And then it got better and it got easier.
Yeah. And so your work, for people that don't know, so your work in Egypt focuses on self-representation generally of Egyptian elites.
Yes.
In the late second, early first millennium BC.
Yeah.
So we don't have to give everyone a rundown of archaeology and what, you know, what that looks at, but as an archaeology anthropology student, of course, I'm well read in this subject. Don't quote me on that. But but so obviously a big part of archaeology, I maybe assume that you love fieldwork.
Yes.
You love you've mentioned Egypt a few times already.
Yeah.
So before then, so you used to go to Egypt, I assume, most of the times of the year. You used to go all...
I used to try to go at least once, twice a year. It's difficult, as I'm sure you're aware, in the Oxford term structure
to get
extended periods of fieldwork. But I would go most spring seasons. I would be in Egypt for a bunch of time, 2 to 4 weeks if I could. And then I was also trying to go in September. So I've been planning two short seasons a year.
So was that in Karnak as well?
That's all in Karnak.
Yeah.
Karnak has been my focus of work for about 5 or 6 years.
Five
now.
Or 6 years. Yeah. So... obviously, you want to go back to Egypt now.
Yeah.
How realistic is that in the sense that, you know, what do you have to put in place to get there? Because, you know, obviously, fieldwork, I've experienced the fieldwork in my 2 weeks in Dorchester, compulsory archaeological fieldwork. And for the record, it was an absolutely fantastic 2 weeks. And thank you
I've
to all.
I've heard that from my students who do it as well. They love it.
Yeah, so thank you so much for everyone in the Department of Archaeology for organising that and for taking 2 weeks of my summer away. But no, but the fieldwork's tough.
Yes.
It's physically tough. Not like the scroungers like me who sort of you go and hide in the tent and make the tea and everything. But it is a very tough thing to trowel and to dig.
It's physically very active.
Yeah. So can you go back to that? You know, what's the likelihood of doing something like that?
Well, this is where, in terms of my work world, the loss around my work has been around my field work because my particular project in Karnak is to record ancient graffiti. So... I have a graduate student here who's fantastic, and she and I have been working together on graffiti in this temple she and I have been working together for about 5 years now. And I draw and I record by drawing and I interpret these graffiti by drawing them. I can't draw anymore. And I remember like howling with rage and grief in the hospital when... after the second surgery on my hands, when the surgeon said, you're not going to have really much use of your hands. And I said to him, will I be able to draw? And he was like, no, you probably won't be able to do much with your hands at all. And yeah, you know, all the things you do with your hands, you eat with them, you write with them, you do everything with your hands.
Yeah.
The loss that I felt was the drawing. And so that's what I can't do. But where me and my student with my family are hoping to go to Egypt in March of this year, so in just a couple of months, and we're going to see what we can manage. So I may not be able to draw, but she can draw, and I can work with her to talk about how we interpret those drawings.
Mm.
So it'll be a team process of her and I working together. She does the drawings and then we discuss them. And a lot of the graffiti that I work on, well, for one of my projects at least, is sort of head height. So I should be able to reach some of it. Another one of my projects, a lot of the graffiti is really high. So we're going to have to figure out, I don't know, ways of using photography or other ways for me to try and work on them. But, you know, I'm very lucky in that I have my graduate student who is shortly about to finish her doctorate, who I hope will stay as part of my team and we'll continue to work together. So I'm lucky to have her. And I also have colleagues. I work with the French Egyptian Center at Karnak. My colleagues there are really, really awesome. And so they're also, I'm in contact with them and we're trying to figure out how this is all going to work. But it's going to be an experiment.
Yeah, well, I suppose it sort of links into what we were talking about generally in terms of, you know, how this, you know, what's happened to you, you're going back to work, changes perceptions of disabilities. But I'm sure within archaeology, I could name, a disabled archaeologist who really, I wouldn't know any off the top of my head.
Yeah.
So surely that, I've done too many essays on methodology within archaeology and everything, but surely that changes the way we actually record things as well. So
absolutely. And I think it's very interesting that you say that, you know, you've had lots of essays around methodology but have disability has never come into it, and you can't think of disabled archaeologists. And that's true. And there was a disabled archaeology network in Britain, but I don't know if it's particularly active, but it was set up by someone at UCL, and UCL and Reading have been quite active in trying to create a kind of disabled archaeology network to kind of think about how people with a whole range of disabilities, not just the visible stuff like mine, but also people that are autistic or have, you know, various types of learning disability, could engage with archaeology and become practitioners, or who already are, and how things might be adapted and changed to make that more possible. So I think that's really, really interesting. And there's a lot of scope, especially now that you have a lot of digital technologies coming
in.
So photogrammetry, all the kind of digital methods for recording, that opens up things and makes things more accessible. So certainly from my own work in Karnak, we're thinking about 3D modeling, photogrammetry, reflective transformation imaging, RTI, which is another great photographic technique, all of which would allow me to continue my work.
Photographic tech. Tell me about, so the technical methods, obviously, digital stuff we just talked about now. So that's something that's really exciting then. It means you can get around that in some sense and also adapt really in the future with archaeology.
Potentially, yeah. And there's a whole intellectual debate within archaeology at the moment around the implications of digital technologies and how much they take practitioners out of the context in which they should be working. And there's a kind of tension between, you know, archaeologists being embedded within the communities they're working in and digital technologies that take them out of those communities. And in contexts, for example, in Turkey or Syria or Iraq, where you have incredible tensions within, you know, how archaeology is practiced within contexts that are devastatingly conflicted. And that's really useful to have these debates going on about how we use digital technologies. For me, it's the answer, I think. But for other people, you know, I have this debate with my husband, who's an archaeologist who works in Turkey, about how much digital technologies allow Western, predominantly white archaeologists to do all of this kind of distanced fieldwork without ever actually engaging on the ground with the people that actually live in these environments.
So it's like the armchair anthropologist.
Anthropology. I mean, we're just going to go back to being armchair anthropologists or armchair archaeologists. And that's maybe the danger. And so there's, you know, as long as we're aware of this, I think it's, and we're talking about it and discussing it. And to come back to Egypt, you know, that's, I never want to stop going to Egypt and trying to balance how we use the digital technologies that will allow me hopefully to do my work with still being in Egypt and walking through the temple and trying to understand why people put the graffiti in the places they did. There's going to be a balance there. And I think, you know, I'll start exploring that, you know, how much I can still engage physically on the ground with my data and with the context, and also do the primary recording that needs to happen. So yeah, it's always challenging and always interesting, but I think I'm hoping that my experience of being disabled in the field, and if I start writing about that and talking about that in different contexts, then that will help, you know, that push that these changes in method and their implications around disability a little bit more to the fore. And maybe in 5 years' time, undergraduates in Arkanth will be writing essays about method in relation to, you know, different forms of disability. And that would be really interesting.
Yeah, so I suppose when we talked about, you know, how your life has changed as a person and now obviously the challenges you face as an archaeologist, but do you see your own research focus then changing? Because we talk about the methodology. Do you say, like, you actually want to explore those things as in more detail? Because a lot of archaeologists will strictly stick to the methodology and not particularly, obviously with reference to sites. But do you think that, you know, you become an activist within archaeology then, in some sense?
Oh, that sounds really cool, doesn't it?
Yeah,
that sounds cool. Awesome. Yeah. Activist archaeologist. Yeah, maybe. You know, I've always been interested for ancient Egypt about kind of how the self is presented and fashioned and constructed in different environments. And my physical self is so radically changed, that's got to change how I think about things. You know, we're not, you know, everything that's happened to me, even if I can't imagine it now, is going to change how I think about self-fashioning and self-presentation in ancient contexts. It's got to. How it does that and the details of that, I'm not clear on yet. And it's going to take me time to figure out exactly how that's going to turn out. But if, you know, the things that I'm redesigning around my work end up being, I think, useful, then yeah, I'll be writing about them and talking about them in different contexts, and maybe that's a direction I'll end up pursuing.
So just focusing on Karnak as well then, and you're looking at self-representation in relation to sort of temples as well in the physical setting.
Yeah.
So obviously you had a bit of time out from, you know, doing archaeology, you know, being yourself for a long time.
Yeah.
So now going back to it, have you got a lot of things to finish in Karnak? Have you some unsolved questions you can share with us maybe?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like I got sick right in the middle of a really important work that I was trying to do, and sort of now I'm gathering all of that together and go, right, where was I?
Yeah.
But I have... well, at the moment in Karnak particularly, I have two major research projects. So I have graffiti in two particular areas of the temple that I'm looking at. The graffiti in these two areas are very different. And so that's one of the questions I'm interested in, is like, why are graffiti practices so different in different parts of the temple? You know, is it different groups of people? Is it different functions that graffiti have in these spaces? How we understand that? And of course, you know, I'm very interested in the relationship of text to context, and graffiti is perfect for that, because you cannot understand a graffito without understanding the space in which it's scrawled or carved into the wall. So my student and I, we're very interested in who could go where in the temple, the day-to-day practices of the temple staff, how and why they're inscribing the things that they do on the temple wall. And I had started out in my early work when I was writing about this graffiti, I was saying, oh, you know, graffiti is an official practice. It's part of the ways that you can formally display yourself in temples. And actually now, and I wonder if it's partly to do with looking for difference now and being very interested in that, I'm now starting to think, well, maybe it's more subversive and more problematic than, you know, I've kind of swung too far towards the let's make graffiti all like legitimate and let's make it a legitimate part of self-fashioning. And now I'm swinging back to thinking, well, maybe it's, you know, there's something a little bit countercultural or a little bit subversive in what people are doing sometimes with graffiti in temple space. And so that's interesting. And I'm kind of excited to explore that question of subversion a little bit more
Yeah, was that, so was that when you sort of, obviously I think that a lot of, as I know, a lot of archaeologists change their mind throughout their career.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad thing.
It's a great thing. So, we should all do that. Yeah. A lot more.
Yeah, but is that, was, would you say you changed your mind because, as in your capacity as an archaeologist, but all these things you say, a lot of, you changed a lot of perceptions about how you look at the self and stuff like that. Was that time out a way in which you went, you revisited the information when you came back to work, and then you just thought, oh, I need to sort of, you know, or it's always been a gradual process. What's it been like?
That's funny, actually, because I've been, you know, what I think stimulated it was, or stimulated me sort of starting to change my mind, was some work I did with Torch. So when okay. I came back, I got sort of slightly, a little bit re-involved with Torch, and especially working with Vicky McGuinness on the Gaps Between project, which put posters of hidden stories of Oxford academics and yeah. Oxford research up all around Oxford. Yes. So I got involved in that. And then I got involved in some work that Marie Tidball, who is amazing, kind of activist and intellectual in Oxford. And so those two kind of projects within Torch, one of them was presenting myself. Mm. And in the context of presenting myself, I had to think about how potentially my disabilities and my losses had changed my research and might change my research practice, and made me aware that I'd always been looking for things that didn't quite fit the norm.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I ended up working on graffiti, because graffiti doesn't quite fit the norm.
Yeah.
And so that kind of crystallized that for me. And then I, you know, just sort of talking with and working with Marie as part of her project on disability and the curriculum in Oxford made me realize how much of say seeking out difference and seeking out things that didn't quite fit normative patterns had been part of my research, even though maybe I hadn't articulated it quite clearly. And so working with her and working with the Torch teams on these projects made me get to this point of like, oh, actually, maybe there is something about the difference, the subversive, subversive maybe a bit extreme, but difference, counter normative practices, and maybe that I should allow myself to see that within the graffiti a bit more clearly, and articulate that a bit more clearly in my research. Sorry, that's probably not making any sense, but I'm still in the early stages of thinking.
That's fine.
About this.
I can see it in a paper in a couple of years' time. Yeah, and I envisage it all. But what's quite interesting is you mentioned sort of your students quite a lot. You love your students; it's great. But you you've talked about how you sort of develop a relationship with these students, and especially now, obviously, you may perhaps rely on them a bit more in different aspects. So do you sort of think that bond between the academic and the student, you sort of appreciate it more maybe in Oxford after what's happened and everything? So
definitely. I mean, and it's hard to articulate that without sounding really kind of soppy about it.
It's okay. We like that. We like that. It's fine.
Okay. My undergraduates and my graduates, you know, when I'm teaching and I'm sitting in a class and we're just talking about the material that we talk about in the teaching context, I can forget about my hands, I can forget about my legs, I can forget about everything, because it's just all completely present and normal. And I hate that word, but you know, you can just kind of, it's all about the work, and the students really allow that. But they're also mostly very kind of sensitive to the things that I can't do. So, you know, if we're looking at a book that has great pictures about a text we're working on in class, they'll turn the pages for me without me really having to ask them to, or they'll write down notes for me about things because they know I can't. I have a team of graduate students that are my research assistants. So they're employed through Access to Work as my support workers. And they're, you know, some of them are actually my students, so I actually do supervise them. Some of them are supervised by other people in my department. And there is a change. You know, you can't maintain that professional distance that maybe we're encouraged to have with our students when, you know, they're figuring out how to make your computer station work better, or they're figuring out how to you know, make teaching notes accessible. And I'm working really closely with these these students to kind of figure out all sorts of problems around my mobility and my hands. And, you know, all of that professional distance just is kind of meaningless in that context. And we work together as a team. And I couldn't do my job without them. And to feel that level of support and to feel that working relationship is really awesome. So with graduate students, I mean, I've always felt that it's not a top-down hierarchical relationship, but you're working together on projects to learn more about the things that, you know, they're interested in or that you're interested in, and it's always this kind of team process. But around, you know, my disability and around trying to figure out how to work with that, that's really kind of crystallized that even more. It's like, yeah, this is a collaborative process, and I'm so lucky to have such a great team to work with on this. You know, it's all about collaboration, and it's the same in my undergraduate classes, right? So even though I'm the teacher, it's about figuring things out together and exploring things together. And I love this sense of the detective process, that we're all together trying to figure things out and collaborating on the process of exploring the particular topics that we're dealing with. So that's really fun. And maybe I was always doing that in my teaching, yeah, but I'm super aware of it now.
Well, it's a fascinating thing. I do remember when I was on an open day to Oxford, that somebody had said in the archaeology department, I think maybe it was Nick Barton, actually, in Hartford, had said, you know, we're all equal here, because we've just read more. They've read far more than me anyway. But
that's true. And I think that really captures the essence of it. It's like, you know, we sit around a table and together we're trying to figure things out. And yes, I may have read a bit more, or I may have read some of these texts several times in the past with different groups of students. Mm. But each time it's new, and the student, whatever students are there, bring new ideas and new questions to the table. And that's the beauty of the Oxford system, is that we have very small groups of students. Often it's one-on-one, or, you know, just the five of us sitting around a table. And we're very, very privileged in that. You know, I used to teach at Liverpool University, which was awesome, and the students were great there, but there were classes of 30.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And it was just a different experience. You can't get that sense of collaborative teamwork solving a problem when there's 30. It's harder to get that when there's 30 students in the class. You can do it, but it's harder. Here, you just go straight into that.
And to finish then, could you give me the three things that you are most looking forward to or most happy about now and going forward?
Ooh.
Which we've probably covered already, but just sum it up for
us. I'll just repeat it all.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about being back teaching and working with my students, so that every day that I'm back in the office, that's really a thrill. I'm a mum again, so, you know, I have a great relationship with my son. He tries to help me put my legs on in the morning. He's only 3 and a half, but he still tries to, you know, help me put my legs on, or talks about my hands and helps me open things. So he's awesome. So I'm a teacher, I'm a mum, and I'm going back to Egypt. I'm going back to Egypt in March, I hope. And I'm terrified about that, but I'm also really, really excited.
Well, we wish you all the best here at Oxide. Thank you so much for coming in, Liz Froude. That's all we've got time for this week. But we'll be on the same time next week, Tuesdays, from 7 till 8. This has been Oxford Today with Theo Davis-Lewis, your station manager. But from me this week, and from Liz and everybody here at Oxide, goodbye.